From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. A corruption crime spree. That's what U.S. attorneys call the actions of Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. Many politicians, including President-elect Barack Obama, are calling for him to step down. According to investigators, phone taps revealed that the governor planned to sell Mr. Obama's vacant Senate seat to the highest bidder. And why are news organizations questioning Jesse Jackson Jr.'s ties to the case? NPR's Cheryl Corley has been reporting on this story for NPR's network of shows, and we're glad to have you on. How are you?
I'm fine. Glad to be with you.
You've been working hard on this. So let's break this down. The governor had been under investigation for several years, but he allegedly maneuvered to auction the vacant Senate seat that Barack Obama held. If that's true, that's no small potatoes. How are people reacting?
Well, in a variety of ways, as you might expect. Some people here are just really disgusted with these charges, the fact that the governor may have been doing this. Others are amazed. Some people are just sad or just plain angry. And I think there's still this just sense of disbelief since Illinois sent a former governor to prison just 2 years ago on corruption charges. And now to have Governor Blagojevich allegedly following that same path, but in an increased level, if you're to believe what the U.S. attorney says, is just really mind-boggling to some people here.
So the governor's chief of staff, John Harris, was also arrested. Is there, give us a sense of the governor, from what I understand, is at work today?
He is at work
today. He's at work today. So so he's at work. He and his chief of staff have been directly targeted or identified. What's the state of play?
Arrested and charged.
Yeah. What's the what's the state of play with their cases?
Well, we haven't been given any kind of date yet about when this will continue. They both went before a judge and, got out on their own recognizance. This is an ongoing investigation. It began in 2003, almost as soon as the governor took office. Some of his top advisors are in jail, and I'll tell you that when he announced the charges yesterday, that U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald said, just really don't speculate about other people that are listed in this criminal complaint, but it wouldn't be any surprise if there are more to come.
Speaking of more to come, there is the question of who would be bidding on the Senate seat. And there is a question of whether they're candidate one through five candidates being bidders in this case. ABC News interviewed Representative Jesse Jackson Jr., Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr., about the case this morning, and he said he was contacted by federal prosecutors but said, quote, I am not a target of this investigation. So he has been viewed as a likely candidate, as someone who could take this Senate seat. Why is he even coming up in this conversation?
Well, in the criminal indictment, which was several pages long, they are a listing of lots of people in this indictment. And there was a Senate candidate number five listed in the complaint. And we've had law enforcement officials confirm with NPR that Jesse Jackson Jr. is the Senate candidate number five that was listed in the complaint. The complaint says the governor claims that he was approached by an associate of Senate candidate number five about that vacancy. But as I mentioned, Peter Fitzgerald says people shouldn't speculate at this time about anybody that's listed in here as unless we're talking about the two people who have been charged, that the federal office might be just talking to people, but it doesn't necessarily mean they are a target.
It sounds as if, in a way, the system of Chicago politics is once again under a shadow. And I bring up the politics in general because you mentioned, you know, Governor Ryan, who is now serving time for corruption, former governor, but also Barack Obama, seen as this new leader out of Chicago. Is he going to have to deal with any distancing from the city that he so clearly loves in order to deal with this mess?
Well, I don't really think so. I mean, he obviously is from Chicago. He'll be moving soon, though, so maybe he won't have to talk about it much. But as far as, you know, the Blagojevich relationship kind of tainting him or something like that, I don't think so. The two have been cordial, but not very close. And today, even, as you mentioned, President-elect Obama is calling for the governor to resign his seat.
Well, Cheryl, thank you so much for this update.
You're quite welcome.
That was NPR's Cheryl Corley speaking to us from NPR's Chicago Bureau. And we're going to take a broader look at politics now, including the auto industry bailout and the Louisiana election of the first Vietnamese American to go to the U.S. Congress. With us, we've got Sherilyn Eiffel, civil rights lawyer and law professor at the University of Maryland Law School, and Ron Christie, the CEO of Christie Strategies. He's also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Hi, folks.
Hello.
Great to be here.
So there's a lot of news. Let's start with Blagojevich. Illinois has had its share of political corruption. We just mentioned that the former governor, George Ryan, is serving a 6.5-year sentence for corruption. Two other Illinois governors have faced legal trouble. So, Ron, do you think that there is anything about the way that politics is structured in Illinois that makes it easier or perhaps more appealing to act ethically out of line if you're a politician?
Well, I hate to generalize, and I hate to speculate about a particular state or a particular city, but the facts are pretty damning here for Rye. I mean, the current governor is under an ethical cloud. The previous governor went to prison, as you mentioned, on corruption charges. You had former Representative Dan Rostenkowski, the very powerful former chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, who went to prison, who had been later pardoned by President Clinton. It just seems to me that the old-style school of politics in Chicago is one that is fast and loose with the truth and, you know, slide me a little brown paper bag of money under the table and let's shake hands and move on. And I had hoped that with the conviction of former Governor Ryan that Chicago had turned the page, that this old-style form of politics had been finally stamped out. But the current indictments and the current situation in the Windy City have me scratching my head and many millions of Americans around the country saying, goodness gracious, what could come next?
Sherilyn, when you look at this case, what do you see in this unexpected investigation? What do you see both in terms of its reflections on national politics and even on the complicated wranglings between parties, the complications of race, the complications of how do you talk about a case with so much innuendo respectfully to the people who may not be involved, whose names come up? You know, how do you make sense of this?
Yeah, it's a mess. I mean, this is, on one hand, I would agree with Ron, and I think everyone would agree that there is something very troubling about what we've seen coming out of Illinois in the past few years. But, you know, I don't subscribe to the, you know, geographic propensity for corruption idea, because we'd have to then throw out, you know, Ted Stevens in Alaska being convicted and Randy Duke Cunningham from California and William Jefferson with the indictments and the $90,000 in the freezer. I do think there is an old style of politics that really has to be rooted out. And in many ways, it's an old style of politics that Barack Obama ran against. This has got to be one of the grossest examples of it. And, you know, and I want to be careful to say that Governor Blagojevich is innocent until proven guilty. But if you've read the transcripts of the tapes, it's pretty gross and bizarre. Particularly because, you know, Farai, it's in many ways not unexpected. I mean, he knew that he was under investigation and had been for some time,
and
for
says
years.
So as much in his own comments. You know,
and almost dared people to say, you know, listen to my phone conversations because everything I say is lawful. And, you know, usually whenever politicians say that, you know, follow me, you won't find anything. You usually find something. So, you know, he really is on the extreme end of the spectrum. But there is a spectrum, and it's something that's got to be addressed. Ironically, what's interesting is that, you know, Barack Obama's phone call to the state Senate leader 3 months ago encouraging the Illinois legislature to pass, you know, their stronger state ethics law, actually, you know, is important here, because that may have, you know, made Blagojevich speed up some of his other activities, because it's not just about the Senate seat. There are a lot of other things that are involved in this operation as well. So, you know, I think Barack Obama stands well in this because he's been speaking out against it, because he did push for the passage of that ethics bill. But, you know, it's not going to take just one man. There's got to be a real change.
Speaking of that, Ron, the Illinois Senator Dick Durbin is calling for a change in the law so that the legislature, not the governor, could replace any empty seats of the kind that Senator Obama, just former Senator Obama, vacated. Do you think that's a good idea?
My first reaction, Farai, is that it's not. I would want to make sure that this isn't a usurpation of the power of the executive branch taken at the prerogative of the legislative branch. I mean, there's a reason why we have separation of powers. There's a reason that this was a power that had been specifically delegated to the governor to exercise in the event of a vacancy of a seat at the federal level that would allow the governor to appoint a new individual to that seat. I think that the right thing, as many across the country continue to echo, would be for the governor to resign, to remove himself from office, and to allow a different selection process to take place. But allowing the legislature to encroach upon the executive power is one that I think that we should be looking at very carefully, and we should not rush to judgment or to pass something very quickly that the citizens of Illinois might later come to regret.
Sherrilyn, I just need a quick comment. Yeah. Good or bad idea?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's actually a good idea, because the mere fact that the governor is sitting at his desk this morning suggests that we're dealing with someone that we can't count on to resign or to do the right thing. And this wouldn't be the legislature. What's been called for is a special election. They're going to have a special election anyway to fill the seat that Rahm Emanuel will be leaving as a result of him becoming Barack Obama's chief of staff. So they're going to have a special election anyway. So it would be up to the voters of Illinois, not to the legislature. So okay. I don't see this as a usurpation of power.
Okay. On that note, we've got Sherrilyn Ifill and Ron Christie. And we're going to ask you both to stay with us, because we are going to talk more politics after a break. And just ahead, also, our bloggers give us their take on the top political news, plus the business side of blogging. Can blogs survive in this economy? This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're back talking about the latest political news with Ron Christie, CEO of Christie Strategies, and Sherrilyn Ifill, a civil rights lawyer and law professor at the University of Maryland Law School. So, guys, we've talked considerably about the Blagojevich case and what's going to happen in Illinois. I want to move on to something else that's going to affect people in the Midwest greatly, and that is whether or not the government is willing to play ball with the automakers. They're close. White House and Congress are close to agreeing on a deal, and what it looks like is that in exchange for a $15 billion loan, automakers are going to be required to improve fuel efficiency. They're looking at also putting aside some money for bus and rail cars for public transit. Ron, what do you think of a deal that would give more federal control over certain of the automakers in exchange for support?
I don't like it, Farai. I don't like it for two fundamental reasons. One, the federal government should not be in the business of picking winners and losers. And the immediate response to that is going to be, well, we helped AIG, we helped other financial institutions, and the reason the government, I thought, had a proper role there to intervene was to make sure that there was liquidity in the marketplace and that there was still money for people to obtain loans and for credit to continue to flow freely. In this particular case, you have an automobile industry that's been out of touch for more than a decade, with structured and leveraged contracts with the United Auto Workers that are out of touch with the American economy. And frankly, let's just take this proposed bailout at face value. $15 billion. What is that going to give you? That's going to give you a bridge loan for the next maybe 3-4 months at tops. Then what? Will these individuals from these automakers return to Washington and seek more money? I think that they need to fundamentally change the way that they operate. They need to shut down the number of franchises they have. They need to modify the existing car lines that they produce to be competitive domestically and internationally. And anything short of that, I think it's just a short stopgap measure that is going to have these same big three automakers returning to Washington for more money in the blink of an eye.
Sherrilyn, there One of the more interesting things that I've read was from futurist Seth Godin, who said, let a thousand flowers bloom, incentivize more companies existing, more car companies that can innovate, even if they're smaller, as opposed to propping up, in this case, two of the big three. But the reality is that we have two automakers desperately in trouble that employ thousands and thousands and thousands of Americans. What's the government's interest in preserving their business?
The economy not going completely in the tank, and it's fairly well in the tank already. I mean, here's the interesting thing is that with all the other bailouts, the AIG and all the others that we've looked at, we've bailed out these various financial institutions with very little opportunity for people on the ground, homeowners, to really get any direct relief. When we're still waiting on that, we see that they were able to do it in Britain, that they did a moratorium on foreclosures and so forth, and we didn't see that happen with those bailouts. Here with the automakers, we're talking about workers. We're talking about the possibility of thousands and thousands of workers being unemployed. Given the recent unemployment statistics that have come out that have shown that we are firmly in a recession and have been for some time, it doesn't seem, frankly, all the economists say it's not one of those times when we can roll the dice and say, let a thousand flowers bloom. It's a nice idea, should have been a nice idea years ago when Congress should have, put CAFE standards in place that would have required the car companies to become competitive or go out of business. But now that we're in this emergency situation, this doesn't seem to be the kind of time in which the country can take the tough love that people want to dish out to the automakers. And so we're going to have to grin and bear it. But like Ron and like many others, I think many people worry that the $15 billion really isn't going to be enough. And the Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, has suggested there's not going to be more money forthcoming because the car companies are not in a position to get federal government loans, after this $15 billion if this doesn't do the trick. So it's a dicey proposition.
And Ron, what do you think of the proposal of having a car czar, a federal position for someone to oversee automaking?
Oh, Fry, I know you know what I think. I'm skeptical.
I have to ask you.
I don't like it. And one quick point. Look, I don't want any of these individuals to lose their jobs. None of us do. But if you look, Chapter 11 works. You look at Circuit City. Circuit City went into Chapter 11 a few months ago to restructure their organization. They're still selling television sets. If you look at United Airlines, they went into Chapter 11 a few years ago to restructure themselves. They're still flying. The big automakers can still restructure themselves. They can go into a form of bankruptcy that will allow the workers to keep their jobs, but most importantly, will allow management and labor to renegotiate their contracts and the way that they do business.
All right. This may be a very quick look at a moment in history, but there's also been a real sort of ethnic and diversity breakthrough for Congress at the expense of a seat in the Congressional Black Caucus. We're talking about William Jefferson of the Congressional Black Caucus, Democratic incumbent in Louisiana, losing his congressional seat to Ann Joseph Gow. He is someone who came to America as a child after fleeing Vietnam, and he will be the first Vietnamese American in Congress. Just quickly, is this a good moment for American politics that we see this diversity? And what does it say about the Congressional Black Caucus? Should the caucus be concerned that one of its members had been fighting so hard for this seat under these corruption allegations and lost? Cheryl.
Well, which one? It's always great to have a first. So it's wonderful to have the first Vietnamese American congressperson. But this has got to be the most idiosyncratic race ever. This is somebody who runs in a 60% Democratic district, lowest turnout perhaps ever, 14% of African American voters turn out in the district, 28% of white voters turn out in the district. Opponent has an 18 count indictment against him. So, is this a precursor of, greater diversity? Some people have said, this is a new day for the Republican Party. This is the new face of the Republican Party. If it is, if this is the strategy, this kind of idiosyncratic race in which no Republican member of the delegation in Louisiana offered financial support to Mr. Gow when he was running for office, this doesn't augur very well for the future.
Ron, a trend or anomaly?
anomaly. This William Jefferson, and I worked with him when I worked on Capitol Hill, and I thought he was a very nice man, but clearly money in the freezer gives pause to return someone to Congress when they are using their office for personal gain. But I don't think this portends any great trend from an ethnicity standpoint. I'm glad that he won. I'm glad, as Sherilyn said, that he's the first. But Republicans need to gain more seats by addition, not subtraction. We need to broaden and diversify our base that will return us to power.
All right. Well, I'm sure there'll be a lot more to talk about over the coming days and weeks. Thank you so much. Take care.
Take care, y'all.
Thanks, Fry.
We were speaking with Sherilyn Ifill, civil rights lawyer and law professor at the University of Maryland Law School, and she joined us from the studios of WEAA in Baltimore, Maryland, plus Ron Christie, the CEO of Christie Strategies. It's the nasty campaign ad that wasn't. A TV commercial that former presidential candidate John McCain thought was too tough has been released online. News & Notes web producer Jeffrey Bennett is back to tell us about that and some of the week's other news. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Farah.
So tell us about this ad.
Well, yeah, as you said, a former McCain staffer gave ABC News an unaired TV commercial that slammed Barack Obama over his ties to the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. It's on our blog, too, so let's take a listen.
Long before anyone knew who John McCain or Barack Obama were, one chose to honor his fellow soldiers by refusing to walk out of a prisoner of war camp. The other chose not to even walk out of a church where a pastor was spewing hatred.
Not God bless America, God damn America!
Character matters, especially when no one's looking.
I'm John McCain, and I approve this message.
Now, that ad never saw the light of day until this week, actually, because Senator McCain had said that Reverend Wright was off limits. So on our blog, Moji Odorinde wrote, "For McCain not to run the ad shows that at his core he's still a decent guy," to which another reader named Hank Hall wrote, "I have no doubt that if McCain thought it would help him, he'd have used it." And Robert Palmquist said this, This ad and all the other tales of the campaign should quickly be forgotten. We need to move on. Let the lesson from McCain be that negative ads do not work."
We also had one of those firestorm moments on our Bloggers Roundtable on Monday. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was a conversation on Monday that focused on the ever-controversial Bob Johnson, founder of BET, starting a new cable TV network. And so let's listen to blogger Sharon Toomer sharing this comment on her blog, Black and Brown News.
Somebody wrote in to BBN, he is a surefire candidate for Coon of the Year.
Yeah, that's the word that started the fury. Jerry Myers wrote in our blog, "I have serious issues with Mr. Johnson, but Coon has a literal kinship with the N-word. I do not draw the distinction." And Kimberly Coleman added this, "The wonderful thing about blogging is that you can say what most mainstream reporters may want to but cannot. Long live freedom of speech." And we should say that Sharon Toomer did not say this word. She said that someone on her blog wrote it, but, you know.
And we are also constantly asking for people to share stories with us of, you know, success and travail. And I would just want to say that we're still thankful for the stories you've shared with us and looking forward to more.
Indeed. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. Jeff Bennett is the web producer for News & Notes, and he joined me from our studios at NPR West. It's time now to see what headlines are firing up our bloggers. With us, we've got citizen journalist and public policy consultant Faye Anderson. She blogs at Anderson at Large. Former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross, he blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister and hosts the Kevin Ross Show on Blog Talk Radio. And Sean Williams, who publishes the blog Dallas South. Hi, guys.
Hi. Greetings.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I just want to give you a little taste of the Blagojevich case. We've been talking about it throughout the show, but here is the governor at a press conference on Monday before his arrest.
"I don't believe there's any cloud that hangs over me.
Governor, well, getting back governor, to that, can we
I think there's nothing but sunshine hanging over me. And by the way, I should say, if anybody wants to tape my conversations, go right ahead. Feel free to do it. I appreciate anybody who wants to tape me openly and notoriously, and those who feel like they want to sneakily and where taping devices, I would remind them that it kind of smells like Nixon and Watergate.
All right, Kevin. It was the I dare you comment. What do you think of his approach to this criminal case?
You know, it reminds me actually of Gary Hart when he was running for president and he was saying to folks, you know, I'm not doing anything and catch me if you can. And I mean, literally, what was it, the next day? I know anybody who has Blagojevich on their Facebook page is immediately deleting any references, any links. I mean, this is horrible. And when you couple that with the 4th District race with Dollar Bill Jefferson, and you see just what's going on in these circles, I'm starting to wonder as a Republican if Democrats aren't showing some signs of imploding.
That sounds potentially like a stretch, considering that in Alaska you had a little Republican implosion. But what do you think? Is this an issue where the Democrat, and I'll throw this to you, Sean, the Democratic Party needs to step up its game because it's heading for the corruption iceberg? How's that for a bunch of mixed metaphors?
Look at it.
There's no doubt that the Democratic Party is going to have to make a move, and I think that they've done that. I think they've addressed it in the past. I do believe that we've seen some of the Republicans, when they have their counterparts getting in these types of ethical binds, they've kind of weighed how it will shift their balance of power. I see the Democrats, knowing that times have changed, making sure that they have no appearance of impropriety as a party and going and addressing this. And hence you've seen President-elect Obama come out strongly condemning this, as well as the leadership of the House.
Now, Sean, can I just say, you know, I love you, but Charlie Rangel right now. Hello, my brother.
And I believe Kevin.
They are
looking into it. He has apologized for what has happened with his taxes. And, you know, he's made the mistake and they're looking at what to do with it. So come on, Kevin.
All right, Faye, I'm going to steer us to a little bit more of this situation. Federal law enforcement sources told ABC News that Chicago Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. is the so far unnamed Senate candidate number 5. We want to be very careful with how we structure this because it is just very much a balloon that's being floated at this point. But here's how Congressman Jackson responded this morning.
I can tell you what I have been informed of, that I am not a target of this investigation, that the U.S. attorney has asked me to come in and share with them my insights and thoughts about the selection process. I plan to do that, of course, after having consulted with counsel. I shared with the U.S. attorney that I would like to do that as quickly as possible, as soon as possible, at their earliest convenience.
And so, Faye, he basically just said, look, I'm not a target. I haven't been included in this investigation. I have been contacted by investigators. Is it unfair to have Congressman Jackson in the media crosshairs at this point, or is it all fair game?
No, I think it's all fair game. And Congressman Jackson said the 5 words no elected official should say, not a target of this investigation. Mm-hmm. I think what it does in the short term, it removes him from consideration for the Senate seat. Reading the affidavit, it was kind of funny when Governor Blago, I'm not even going to try to pronounce
Blagojevich.
His name.
Blagojevich, yeah.
Blago. When, when he talked about candidate number 5, that, you know, he's had problems with him in the past in terms of reneging on a commitment. But, you know.
Can't hear her.
You know what? We'll be going to a break shortly, and we'll be able to tweak anything that needs tweaking. So go ahead, Faye. Just finish your thought.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, pick up on what Kevin said earlier about Gary Hart. When I read saw the video, I immediately thought of Gary Hart. And also Richard Nixon, who told David Frost, and I quote, well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal. Clearly, the governor has learned nothing from history.
All right. That's a great place to leave it before the break. We have to go to a break, guys, but we're going to be back with our bloggers roundtable, including having our bloggers tell us what the impact is of the economy on their work and their audiences. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We are back with our Bloggers Roundtable. We're talking to citizen journalist and public policy consultant Faye Anderson. She blogs at Anderson at Large. Former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross. He blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister and hosts The Kevin Ross Show on Blog Talk Radio. Plus Sean Williams, who publishes the blog Dallas South. So let's jump right back into the topics. You guys are part of the media for many years.
Really? Have we arrived?
For many years. Well, see, that's,
you like
that's,
us. You really like us.
That's the question. The question is, did you arrive just in time to turn around and head home? What we're going to talk about is media economics because, you know, television stations, newspapers, everyone is having difficulties. Kevin, the National Association of Black Journalists is calling on the industry to keep diversity in the forefront as there's these cost-cutting measures at places like Gannett, the Tribune, everywhere. Some blogs, one of our sister blogs, Stereohyped, have shut down. So I'm going to back into the media topic and ask you first about blogs. What do you feel is the future for black blogs? Is there a future in this climate?
I totally believe that we are at the precipice of something great. They say that necessity is the mother of invention. I would submit to you that necessity in this case is the mother of reinvention, because you have traditional media, particularly black media, that has had a very limited and somewhat dim view of bloggers. It's like, well, you all aren't really quote-unquote journalists. Meanwhile, people like Sean Williams, who has his Dallas South blog, is not only blogging, but now Sean has a blog talk radio show. And Faye and I have been corresponding back and forth. And Faye is like, you know what? I want to add a different component to my blogging. What you're seeing is we are becoming the next generation of media folks who are seeing this from a 360 view. It's about blogs. It's about internet radio. It's about digital content. You know, Sean and I met in Atlanta for the Bloggers Conference, and that conference was unable. Blogging While Brown Conference. It was in Atlanta this year. Next year, it's going to be in Chicago. We couldn't get traditional media sponsors. So we took it upon ourselves. Sean and I said, you know what? Let's link. Let's connect with each other. So when I'm in Miami this past weekend and I'm hearing Ricky Smiley talking about the Cotton case, the Shaquana Cotton, I think that's the name, mm-hmm. Sean.
That's right.
And he was saying how he took it upon himself to help free her because he was reading on a blog. I'm listening to that going, no, he was reading Sean's blog, Dallas South blog. Mm-hmm. And I know that he was instrumental in galvanizing other people. And that's the direction that I see media, irrespective of race, they're going to have to look to us to create some synergy.
Since, you know, your blog came up, Sean, do you consider yourself someone who is a reporter, a analyst, an advocate?
All of the above, right? You know, like Faye, I consider myself a citizen journalist. But, you know, I think a lot of us as bloggers, especially starting a couple years ago when we didn't know where it was going to go, you know, we're idealists. And, you know, we want to do the good thing and the right thing, and we want to be advocates. But we've learned that, you know, there's a cost to doing business that way. And to bring up the Blogging While Brown Conference again, you know, it's kind of like pulling teeth at some point to try to get people to talk about how do we monetize our blogs, how do we finance our blogs so that we can do this, some of us who want to do it on a more permanent basis. And it was really hard to get people to have that discussion. But, you know, if we don't want more blogs to start shutting down, if we want to supplement what's going on in traditional media, we're going to have to find a way to finance these endeavors.
Preach.
Faye, what's that mechanism? Because consumers don't want to pay for media, which is affecting big media and small media. Advertisers are hurting because they're corporations that have customers that don't want to buy a lot of things right now. So where's the money going to come from?
Well, surprisingly enough, the money will likely come from the mainstream media. Farai, let me just say up front, 99.9% of bloggers don't make any money from blogging. They do it, we do it out of passion. That said, out of crisis comes opportunity, that the newspaper industry has been in decline for some years. They, like the auto industry, will have to find ways to cut their labor costs. Bloggers, freelance writers, they will look to bloggers and freelance writers as as cheap labor. For the last, I guess, 3 or 4 years now, I have been participating in an annual convening, Journalism That Matters. Actually, I've been the token blogger up until recently, and is looking at what's next in the newsroom. And what I told them, well, try to get across, I shouldn't say told, try to get across, is that, yeah, editors are looking to bloggers to supplement as they shed staff to bring to use bloggers, but they can't use the model of putting some token donation in our tip jar and think that we are going to provide them with labor. Bloggers will come cheaper than traditional journalists because we'll come without the benefits. But I think increasingly they will, the mainstream media will turn to bloggers as a source of cheaper labor.
All right. Well, we are going to have to end it there, but this is a great conversation that I definitely want to continue. That brings up a lot of bigger issues about how the media will unfold ahead. So I want to thank the three of you.
Thank you so much, Brian.
We've been talking with Sean Williams, who publishes the blog Dallas South. He was at Cake Mix Recording Studio in Dallas, Texas. And I have to say, I love the name Cake Mix Recording Studio. I don't know who came up with that. Citizen journalist and public policy consultant Faye Anderson. She blogs at Anderson at Large and NPR's election blog Sunday Soapbox. She was at our New York studios. And former L.A. Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross, who blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister. He was with me at our NPR West studios. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation does not stop here. Our online series Speak Your Mind gives you a chance to sound off on the issues you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind. An actor's actor, that's the term used to describe someone who's well-respected in the acting world. It's also a good way to describe Tony Award winner Viola Davis. She's playing a key role in the new movie Doubt, based on the play of the same name. It's a story about recriminations and allegations at an all-white Catholic school in the Bronx in the 1960s. Davis plays the mother of Donald Miller, the first black student at the school. Meryl Streep plays Sister Aloysius, a nun who's concerned about Donald's relationship with a parish priest.
I don't care why. My son needs some man to care about him and to see him through the way he wants to go. And thank God this educated man with some kindness in him wants to do just that.
This will not do.
It's just till June.
I'll throw your son out of this school.
Why would you do that if it didn't start with him?
Because I will stop this.
Viola Davis has been getting plenty of buzz for the role and says she was drawn to the character of a woman who's torn between imperfect options for her son.
The fact that it's imperfect, the fact that she's complicated and she has duality and contradictions, because I usually play the metaphor and I usually play the archetype and the function to bring about some emotional change to or for the lead character. And I was attracted to the fact that this is a fully realized human being. That's what you're trained to do in acting school, is to play a three-dimensional human being. And it was very attractive to me.
You're one of the linchpins of this drama, centering around different levels of belief.
Yes.
How did you grow up in terms of looking at belief? You know, as a child, did you have a belief system that was either based on religion or your own heart? And how do you think that's evolved over time?
I did not grow up with any religion because I was born in St. Matthew, South Carolina, on a plantation in my grandmother's house. My grandmother delivered me. And of course, they had a lot of religion there. But once we moved to Central Falls, Rhode Island, being the only black family in 1965, it was a huge Catholic community. And we were on the periphery. And we lived in abject poverty and dysfunction, which is a horrific combination. And feeling like you are the only one, being black, being on the periphery, belief system becomes almost imperative. You just have a general belief in God and prayer because there is no tangible evidence of dreams and goals. And so the only thing you have is to put your hands together and get on your knees, which we did often. And to be inspired, to rely on inspiration. People sometimes downplay the power of inspiration. I don't.
At what moment did you say, I can do this, despite the fact that, as you've already said, there's not a lot of room for black actresses to flex their wings. What made you head in this direction?
Well, a combination of all the things I told you, the faith, the prayer, looking for the inspirations. But also, it's the one thing that they say makes marriages work and relationships work, is you do what you have to do to get it done. I made the commitment, knowing that it always wasn't going to be a smooth ride. But I felt like my only two choices was to either make it or not. Mm. And the not wasn't an option.
Right. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming when you say doing the work, it means that you probably spent some time in theaters where there weren't always a lot of people in there, and you still had to deliver a performance anyway.
Well, I not only did theater where there wasn't a lot of people. I remember I did one-woman show where there was actually one person in the audience. I have been attacked by dogs while I've been performing. I have done it all. You know what? When you fall in love with something, you understand the commitment to it. And that's a really strong word, because with commitment comes the knowledge that it is the journey that you're in it for. And the journey isn't always going to be nice and smooth. And so I think it's the fact that I fell in love with the work that got me through, too, and not the celebrity. If I fell in love with the celebrity and the bank, I'd be pretty miserable even right about now, because I've been unemployed for quite a few months. But I wanted to master something and do it well. I thought that that would make me somebody for some reason. I felt that from a very young age.
All right, I have to ask you about the attacked by dogs story. What was that about? In what context? And, you know, what happened?
Well, someone had the weird idea of giving me a chance to do this one-woman show about Cicerita Jones that I toured throughout the state of Rhode Island. And I was very bad with the singing, by the way. But the acting, I said, I think I can get through it if I do the acting. And one of the places I had to perform was a basketball court. And by the way, they never stopped playing basketball while I was performing the one-hour, one-woman show in a full silk gown, by the way.
Whoa.
And so it was while I was in the middle of screeching one song that the dog kind of appeared on the basketball court and was very, very intrigued by my long blue silk dress. But I thought to myself, you know what? If I could get through this, nothing else is going to faze me, you know? I could get through anything.
I know that you were in Providence and not New York, but it's reminding me of that song. If I can make it there, I can make it anywhere. If you can make it on a basketball court with a dog trying to rip your dress off, then you can probably make it anywhere.
Once again, it's back to the commitment, right? You know, it's the same thing in relationships. You know you're going to have bad patches, but you're in it for the long haul. You see the full journey. So, yeah, the dog. Very interesting moment.
Let's go back to this movie, Doubt. Okay. You have a pivotal scene with Meryl Streep, and she does some amazing things with her face in this movie, where this is not giving anything away, but her basic unhappiness with life and the situation she's found herself in play out over the canvas of her face.
Yes.
And you also brought a specific face to the scene.
My boy came to your school because they were going to kill him in a public school. His father don't like him. Come to your school, kids don't like him. One man is good to him, this priest. Then does a man have his reasons? Yes. Everybody does. You have your reasons, but do I ask the man why he's good to my son? No.
How would you describe your face in that scene?
I think that I had the face of a mother who loved her son above all else. And I felt like I had the face of someone who was loving someone against tremendous obstacles. I would hope that that's what people see.
You've got a great buzz for this movie, and how much does it matter to you that you're getting recognition for this role?
It means everything and nothing. It means everything because it's like August Wilson said in one of his characters in Seven Guitars, who's an artist, a blues musician, and he has a line that says, you know, he didn't know if he could make his music work for him. He didn't know if he could put it out there in the world and have it burst in the air and have it mean something to somebody. That's what every artist wants. I don't care what they say. The bottom line is they want to do something that moves people, that affects them in some way, or else what you do is kind of meaningless. So when you get all the buzz and the reaction, you know it's hitting someone. The part that means nothing is the part that hasn't translated into anything tangible. Buzz doesn't pay the mortgage. Buzz doesn't, you know, buzz is buzz. And it's also what you don't really do the project for. And I always kind of feel, you know, it's just me. It's once again, they're going to find me out. They're building me up just to knock me down. You know, that's the part that doesn't mean anything because you know what? At the end of the day, you got to keep working. I am a theater-trained actress. I'm not a fluke. I'm not a body. I'm not a face. I'm an actor. I want to be able to do what Helen Mirren, Meryl Streep, all of them are doing. That is my dream.
Viola, it has been fabulous and inspirational to talk to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Farai.
Tony Award-winning actress Viola Davis. She plays Mrs. Miller in the new film Doubt. The movie opens this Friday, December 12th. You can watch video of this interview at our website, nprnewsandviews.org.